Hey guys, welcome to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. I don't know who Ricky is, but I think that Ad Rock and Mike D should rename this song Scott's Theme. Because I've used it a lot more than this Ricky guy, whoever the hell he is. No, I don't know. The hell do I know? That's my song, man. All right, so yeah, it's my show. I'm him, and yeah, scotthorton.org is the website. You can find all my crap there. Tons of it. I've done more than 3,800 interviews since 2003, and you can find virtually all of them. There's a lost Ivan Eland. There's a lost Glenn Greenwald. I one time interviewed this guy who, he was so worthless, and I just deleted that one. That was no good. And then, I think that's it, basically. Oh, they're all there, man. Oh, there was a Ron Paul activist who asked me to take his down because he had to get a job. So there was that. Oh, and there was an anti-war soldier I interviewed one time who asked me to take his down, too, because he was afraid of the clamp down. Yeah. Other than that, though, that's it. That's all of them. I think. I know there's one anonymous soldier on there. Anyway. 3,800 interviews, all there at scotthorton.org/interviews. And in fact, if you go to scotthorton.org/all-interviews-2. Then that'll take you to a page of all of them. All of them. I'd like to print that out. I should print that out and see how long it is. It's a pretty big page, man. scotthorton.org/interviews or whatever. Anyway. Also, join up the chat room during the show, man. We've got a good group of people in our chat room daily here. It is our chat room. Right, guys? Yeah. So, yeah. Hey, chat room guys. Welcome to the show today. Hey, all you listeners who aren't chat room guys, become a chat room guy. All you got to do is go to scotthorton.org/chat. And then I will read your stuff belatedly during the commercials and think, oh man, I wish I'd read that when he wrote it. Today on the show, Norman Singleton is going to be on. Cool, man. I like Norman Singleton. You know, I don't guess I've spoken with Norm since I don't know when. God dang. When was the last time I went down to a Ron Paul barbecue? That would have been, I guess, 2009 or something. I don't know. Anyway, good old Norm Singleton. He used to work for Ron Paul. Now, I guess he still does. He's part of the Campaign for Liberty. And he's going to be on to talk about Rand Paul's pseudo-filibuster thing yesterday, as well as the, you know, what it was all about, the Patriot Act and the USA Freedom Act and what it's all about, what the Campaign for Liberty is doing about it. So that'd be cool, man. And then Patrick L. Smith is going to be on. I just interviewed him for the KPFK show a couple of weeks back. But now I want to interview him again. Why? Because he wrote a thing again. It's about Ukraine. And I don't want to tell you any more than that because it'd be a spoiler. Unless you already read the article or you saw it on antiwar.com today or, you know, this kind of thing, then it is what it is. But Patrick L. Smith is going to be on. And I know I should have a button that where the laughter breaks out when I say he writes for salon.com. But he's great, though. So for whatever reason, that's who he's doing business with. But I don't care about that. He's just writing good articles. That's what's important. So, yeah, man, it's about Ukraine. Did I already say that? I don't want to spoil it too much, but it's about Ukraine. So, yeah, okay. More Norman Singleton fans I see on my Twitter page right now. All right. Yeah, man, chat room's rolling. talking about El Caminos and things. Dar Jamail's going to be on the show tomorrow. He's writing about war games in Alaska and up in the Arctic Circle. Yeah, the American Empire. They just don't stop killing people and things. Animals. Pristine wilderness. So, that'd be cool too. I like Dar Jamail. And you know, when he went from the Iraq beat to the environment beat, which I understand, the dude's probably shell-shocked all the hell. I quit reading him because I don't care about all that environmental crap. But I kind of do, just not really, you know? But so then he writes an article like this where it's about the Pentagon's literal, not figurative, literal war on the environment. And I like talking about that. Of course, everybody knows the U.S. military is the number one polluter in the world. The U.S. government, the rest of the U.S. government is in second place. Oh, I don't know, maybe the Chinese government. But certainly in America, the Pentagon and the government are way out ahead of any industry when it comes to pollution. And why wouldn't they be? You know, that's where all their incentives are built, is into not taking responsibility. So anyway, good old Dar, man. He's a good guy. He's a good reporter. And he's going to be on to talk about all that. Now, you know, Jesse Trenadu sent me this morning. It's our friend Will Grigg at LouRockwell.com. False flags, biker gangs, and the PatCon legacy. If only I had had an opportunity to read this morning. Goodness, don't tell me that these biker gangs all shoot each other or infiltrated by the FBI and they were the ones who recommended arming them up. And I'm going to read this thing. You know, PatCon, that was the FBI's infiltration of the radical right and led to the Oklahoma City bombing. Sure seems like if we could get our tampered witnesses to show up in court. Might find out a little bit more about that. Isn't that interesting that you had the Oklahoma City bombing anniversary come and go, the 20th anniversary this year, and there's no mention really in the media at all of an actual Oklahoma City bombing trial proceeding in federal court in Utah? You'd think that might have worked its way in the headline somehow, except maybe then they'd have to explain why, and then that could be problematic. But, by the way, a couple things. Oh, we'll get back to this Syria and Iraq war here in just a minute. But I do think, yeah, you know, I don't know. Maybe this is, you know, fits in with war propaganda or whatever. I still think it's important anyway, in a way. They're saying that the Islamic State has now seized this town of Palmyra in Syria, which has all these ancient ruins, which according to these guys' tradition means stuff to destroy. And so this is where I blame George W. Bush and Barack Obama, because George W. Bush invaded Iraq and Barack Obama supported the veterans of the jihad in the Iraq war in Libya and in Syria, what led to this. So it's 100% George W. Bush's fault and 100% Barack Obama's fault. And of course, the individual members of the Islamic State and their leadership, they're all 100% responsible for their own actions too. But it's still all Bush and Obama's fault. They should be in the dock together. They ought to be in the Supermax next to Ted Kaczynski and Ramzi Youssef for the rest of their crappy lives. The both of them. Just one guy's humble opinion, you know. You hate government? One of them libertarian types? Or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers. Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still, if you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders, quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. and, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future Freedom Foundation at fff.org/subscribe. Since 1989, FFF has been pushing an uncompromising moral and economic case for peace, individual liberty, and free markets. Sign up now for The Future Freedom, featuring founder and president Jacob Hornberger, as well as Sheldon Richmond, James Bovard, Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, and many more. It's just $25 a year for the print edition, $15 per year to read it online. That's fff.org/subscribe. And tell them Scott sent you.
Oh, I meant to fit this in the first segment. Did you see that, according to the government, they released Bin Laden's reading list? Of course, we talked yesterday about, I used that as a springboard to talk about Michael Scheuer for a minute. They're saying that he had Anthony Sutton, the best enemy money can buy, about the Soviet Union from the 1970s. Isn't that funny? I told that to Eric Garris from Antiwar.com. He busted out laughing and said, oh, Sutton would have loved that, to know that Eric knew Anthony Sutton back when. He said, oh, he would have loved that, man. That's funny. And then I thought it was funny, too, that at least, you know, according to them, that he had David Ray Griffin's 9/11 Truther book. And so I was thinking, you know, the possibilities there are one, I guess, you know, the obvious that, like, well, he's just curious about this. What's all this, you know, all these people trying to take his sunshine away or whatever, all his credit, and spin this other theory? Or he really didn't do it, and he wants to know how it was, who really did do it, because, boy, they sure did blame me. Yeah, right. Anyway, I just thought that was kind of funny. Assuming it's true at all, who knows? But I don't know. I guess it's plausible, right? He had put out a podcast before saying that people should read Chomsky, Scheuer, and William Bloom. So that makes perfect sense. You know? I don't think I've ever interviewed William Bloom. I think I have that guilty thing about I should have read at least one of his damn books. And probably all of them. That guy doesn't get enough play. He really should get more play. He does great work, man. He's got, like, for example, the ultimate list of every regime change and war that America's done since the end of World War II and all that. He's the go-to guy for that. Former State Department official. All right. Anyway, I thought that was funny. He's reading Anthony Sutton. That's cool. It's not cool. It's hilarious. That's what it is. It's hilarious. And then, blam, did you see this thing, man, in the dang darn Telegraph today? So, remember we talked about conflict of interest, business interests, between Max Blumenthal's father, Sidney Blumenthal, who, by the way, wrote some really interesting stuff about Republican politics in the Bush Jr. years for Salon.com, Baker versus Pearl, and this and that kind of thing. It will pique your fancy, I promise. If you read it, you will be fascinated. Well, maybe not. You'll be interested. But anyway, so Sidney Blumenthal, why, he's a friend of Hillary, which really makes you wonder, how could a person be a friend of Hillary, you know? I don't know. Anyway, so he is, and now she's tripped herself up on this email thing by trying to hide her email. She just drew attention to him, and so now it's on. Everybody wants Hillary's emails big time from her time at the State Department, and they're getting the release of some. And what they've got here is not about Blumenthal conflict of interest advising business groups on their, you know, future possibilities and all this and that. But it's so-called, quote, UK game playing. I guess the war wasn't going so well. You guys hear my stomach growling? I guess the war wasn't going so well. And so they were saying, well, you know, maybe we'll just go ahead and cut a deal with Saif Gaddafi, the son, put Gaddafi in exile, and just let the rebels keep the east. Now, that's interesting because that reminds me of the Washington Times reporting about the CIA and the military trying to arrange a deal with Saif Gaddafi Is it safe or scythe? I don't know. I only read it. To be the new leader of Libya. And we talked about this with Alex Cooperman, who's a professor at UT here in Austin, who he had written about the false pretense for war back in 2011. And then he wrote this giant thing that I interviewed him about, say, 2 or 3 months ago in Foreign Affairs about what a disaster the Libya war has been. And we talked about that in the Washington Times reporting about how, hey, save Gaddafi. You know, it wasn't like, oh, he was just Uday or Kusay kind of a thing. He really was a reformer. He really did. You know, if they'd given the assuming a lot, like, hey, regime change and war. But assuming that, if they'd, you know, cut some kind of deal to get rid of Muammar and keep his son safe, things could have, you know, there was a lot of promise there, basically. I'm not saying governments at all, ever, are legitimate, because I'm not saying that. But I'm just saying, in this context, in this narrow context, it sure as hell, you know, there's a 99% chance that it would have been a better outcome than what's happened since. Although, it didn't really occur to me, guiltily admit, when I was reading the Washington Times story about this deal or talking with Cooperman, that that would have meant splitting the country in half, which, you know, it's already splitting, you know, back into two or three now. But yeah, I guess, if they were going to keep safe Gaddafi, they weren't going to let him put down the whole rebellion. Although, I don't know, maybe Muammar would have, if they hadn't started bombing when they did, maybe he would have put down the rebellion within just a couple of weeks, because there really wasn't much of one. Remember Patrick Coburn? We talked with Patrick Coburn from Libya, saying, oh yeah, I just got back and there's more of us reporters than there are men at the front. There's not much of a rebellion here. Most of the rebellion is the NATO air campaign flying overhead. And special forces on the ground using laser designators to pick targets for them. And then, yeah, there's some, you know, basically Al-Qaeda kooks left over from the Iraq war who come home to Libya. And as Michael Scheuer put it on CNN, remember he got in that famous fight with the ladies on CNN and said, you're just carrying water for Barack Obama. And they were like, what does carrying water mean? But he was saying, listen, the rebels who are fighting this war, they're the Mujahideen. If we're fighting against them any other place, we would say they're Mujahideen. That's who they are. And the ones who are the most anti-American, they're not talking with us. But that doesn't mean they're not there. And now, hell, you know, I don't know who Hakeem al-Belhaj works for nowadays. Al-Qaeda veteran of the Iraq war now wears a three-piece suit. Who knows who all he's dealing with? Probably everybody. But you got Ansar al-Sharia and the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group and their remnants. Those are the Libyan-Iraq war veterans. Different factions of them declaring loyalty to the Islamic State or to Al-Qaeda. Run a wild. And then, yeah, check this thing out at the Telegraph. The headline is, Britain hid secret MI6 plan to break up Libya from the U.S., Hillary Clinton was told by Sidney Blumenthal, her confidant. It's in the frontline section today at antiwar.com, right there next to the picture. Hey, Al Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. If this nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone, we are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at scotthorton.org or thewarstate.com. In America today, teachers, cops, judges, and other so-called public servants make far more than the average taxpayer. And their pensions? Well, if the people knew, they'd join us. That's where you come in. Taxpayers United of America is embarking on a great new project to train activists how to take on the parasites in your communities. The entire process, from prying loose the facts to disseminating the truth to the people. The next one is June 13th in Denver. It's just $5 if you sign up now at taxpayersunited.org/govpensions.
All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. First up today is Norm Singleton from the Campaign for Liberty, formerly on Ron Paul's staff, Congressman Ron Paul's congressional staff for many years, now at the Campaign for Liberty. Hey, Norm, how are you?
I'm doing all right. How are you?
I'm doing great. So I need to turn you down just a little bit here. Hey, man, it's good to talk to you again. It's been a long time.
Yeah, it has. It's good to talk to you and good to talk to, or hope all your listeners are doing well.
Yeah, they're great. Don't worry about them. Hey, listen, so you wrote a bunch of great stuff, and I want to talk to you all about that, but we got to start with yesterday was Senator Rand Paul's best day, if you ask me. You may know I've been kind of critical of him in the past, to say the least. So yesterday he did this thing that was sort of kind of filibuster, but not really. He went on for hours and all against the Patriot Act, and not just against the Patriot Act and focusing on Section 215, which is important. But he also, he was certainly bringing up Executive Order 12333, and I think he must have probably been also bringing up FISA Amendments Act 702, although I didn't see that part. But he's basically taking on the entire, pseudo-legality of the mass surveillance state in America. It was a pretty good show on C-SPAN 2 yesterday. And so I guess, first of all, could you just clarify for us why exactly that wasn't a filibuster? It wasn't the reauthorization that he was preventing from getting through. What was it that he was doing exactly?
The House is currently on Trade Promotion Authority, which is what you and I might remember as Fast Track,
mm-hmm.
Which is where they basically say, oh, the president gets this authority and to negotiate a trade deal, and the Senate and the House have to vote up or down on it. They can't amend it.
Right.
And so... it's somewhat controversial. There's attempts to add amendments dealing with currency manipulation, for example, because some members think that some other countries are manipulating their currency, whereas our Federal Reserve never manipulates currency. Janet Yellen does not do that. That's why she's fully comfortable with an audit. Because she has nothing to hide. Because if you have nothing to fear, Scott, remember,
man,
if you have nothing to fear, you have nothing to hide.
Coffee here.
Yep. But anyway, so what Senator Paul did yesterday was, during debate on that, he took to the floor and basically took from, I think, 1:20 to 11:14 of the debate time on that. And it wasn't during the debate on Section 215 and the other expired provisions extensions, but it did delay the time on TPA, and by doing that, he did eat into the time that they will have on Patriot Act reform. And so it did throw a monkey wrench into the Senate for the week. It's just it wasn't exactly where... procedurally where the bill that he was actually talking about was being considered yet. And I think that's where the confusion was. But in terms of holding up the Senate, which is, of course, the issue in a filibuster, it did achieve that. And most importantly, it did focus at least the politically aware and those of us who are concerned about these issues, it refocused our attention on these important issues, and I think hopefully brought to light not just a lot about what they're doing, but about some of the flaws in the constructive alternative proposals that have been floated out there, particularly the USA Freedom Act.
Mm-hmm. All right, well, we'll get to that in just a second, but I wanted to point out, too, that he was also talking about other parts of the Patriot Act besides the surveillance, talking about the sneak and peek warrant and you know, I forget if he got into library records and all that kind of stuff. But anyway, certainly was talking about the sneak and peek and the rest of the Patriot Act. So, but now that's not up for sunset, is it?
No, no, it's not. It's most. It's only. It's 215, and I think the so-called lone wolf provision and one other provision are up for sunset.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And then, so now, all right, so that makes sense. So he's gumming up the works in the procedure. And then, so you're saying, I guess, and I read this, that the House is running out of time. They basically don't have time to reauthorize. Wait, but so how is his speech in the Senate screwing up the House? That's where I
missed. Oh, I thought it was screwing up the House. I'm sorry if I said how I meant the Senate. The House passed the USA Freedom Act last week, and they sent it to the Senate. The 215 expires on June 1st, but next week is Memorial Day, and the House and Senate are both scheduled to be out of town. So basically, what Senator Paul is doing is forcing the Senate to work through the weekend, work maybe into next week, depending on how the next 48 to 72 hours go. And anyone who knows anything about the House and Senate knows that they really don't like to cancel their recesses.
I mean, if you call it work, you probably don't, but they don't like even doing whatever it is you call it.
Yeah, and what for the House, I mean, Boehner has said that he is going to adjourn the House today after votes. In fact, they may have already be on their last votes of the week, and he's not intending to call them back because he wants the Senate to pass his phony reform bill. So it really could throw a big monkey wrench into this, and it's possible that the end result could be one that actually results in our favor. If they don't kill 215 outright, or if they don't get a deal by June 1st, at that point they don't get a deal by June 1st and 215 expires, and they have to keep on working on this. At that point, sort of the landscape changes, because now you're looking at coming back and putting something into law that was there, as opposed to just expanding something that was already that had been in law, and it's just very different to, and very much very easier to block something that has already been killed from coming back than it is to stop something that's already in there from being expired.
But now, so if McConnell moves to go ahead and reauthorize it and make some kind of deal before June 1st, has Paul said that he will at that point then filibuster
He hasn't said that specifically, but he has said that he will do everything in his power.
Because you're saying it's still open. I mean, that could still happen.
Yeah, I mean, we don't know what's going to happen when they actually move to the bill itself. And even without a filibuster, all Senator Paul or any other civil libertarian senator has to do is, at this point, is just say we're going to take all the time, because under Senate rules, there's like 30 hours after the first cloture motion, and another 30 hours. I mean, a senator can really drag things out by just denying unanimous consent, and then
by design. Yeah. All right. Now, yeah. I'm sorry. Hold it right there. We'll be right back with Norm Singleton from the Campaign for Liberty. Y'all, one sec. Hey, Al Scott here. If you've got a band, a business, a cause, or campaign, and you need stickers to help promote, check out thebumpersticker.com at thebumpersticker.com. They digitally print with solvent ink, so you get the photo quality results of digital with the strength and durability of old-style screen printing. I'm sure glad I sold thebumpersticker.com to Rick back when. He's made a hell of a great company out of it, and there are thousands of satisfied customers who agree with me, too.
Let thebumpersticker.com help you get the word out. That's thebumpersticker.com at thebumpersticker.com.
Don't you get sick of the Israel lobby trying to get us into more war in the Middle East? Or always abusing Palestinians with your tax dollars? It once seemed like the lobby would always have full spectrum dominance on the foreign policy discussion in D.C. But those days are over. The Council for the National Interest is the America lobby, standing up and pushing back against the Israel lobby's undue influence on Capitol Hill. Go show some support at councilforthenationalinterest.org. That's councilforthenationalinterest.org.
All right, guys, welcome back. I'm Scott. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. I'm talking with Norm Singleton from the Campaign for Liberty. And we're talking about Ron Paul's pseudo sort of kind of filibuster thing. 10 or 12 or so hour long speech, 10 hour speech he gave yesterday against the Patriot Act. And I think, you know what, I'll just go ahead and comment, Norm, in case you might agree and know somebody who knows somebody kind of thing, then I would point out that Rand is at his best when he's attacking the right from the right unapologetically, as opposed to, say, for example, pandering before them. And really accusing all of the other Republican candidates and their, you know, pro-government position on all of these things as being very big government liberal intrusiveness. And it's the same argument for foreign policy, too, that, you know, he could, it seems to me, argue quite clearly that, you know what, it's true. I'm not a right-wing conservative Republican. But I'm not some rhino. That's Jeb Bush. That's the liberal Republican. I'm the libertarian. The liberal Republican and the rest of you so-called conservatives seem to be for everything. Well, I'm against it all. I just want peace and the Bill of Rights and an end to the bailouts and just make that case that they're all the bunch of rhinos for being for all these big government liberal policies that make them essentially indistinguishable from Hillary Clinton. And then that way he doesn't have to flip-flop all around pandering and changing his story depending on who he's talking to and trying to please everybody. He could just go ahead and fight for liberty in more of a uniform kind of a way and just look at it. I mean, his two greatest moments are opposing drones, sort of, kind of, that was a weird thing, but more or less, given his great Brennan filibuster on drones, and then this thing with the Patriot Act, where he's taking a hell no, this is our line in the sand, and we demand our Bill of Rights kind of a position, and that's his strong suit, not pandering and saying, no, look at me, I swear I'm just as bad as the rest of you guys when it comes to Iran and Palestine and everything else like that. But anyway, that's just my overly long take. But it was really great what he did yesterday. And as you're saying, procedurally, it seemed to have, you know, really worked, at least so far, in terms of gumming up the works and running out the clock on the reauthorization of the Patriot Act, which, if that's really true, then that's heroic right there. That's not just a speech. That is, you know, throwing a real monkey wrench into the works of the surveillance state there. So, you know, good times, man. I'll celebrate stuff like that for sure.
It is, and apparently I just saw that for those confused as to what the point of doing it yesterday was, is that by going till close to midnight, he outlasted Senate leadership. So when he yielded back time, there was no one to file any cloture petitions on trade promotion, any Patriot Act related legislature. The other thing they have to do is highway funding, because who will build the roads? It looks like the earliest they can start debate is Saturday, which pushes them up right into the Memorial Day holiday. At this point, they're going to be scrambling, I bet, to see if they can get the votes to pass the USA Freedom Act, because one thing that it did is some of the USA Freedom Act supporters are now talking about wanting to work to strengthen it. There are some amendments that were not allowed in order on the House floor or in the House committee that were actually worth supporting, offered by Thomas Massey of Kentucky in the House floor, and the same amendment was tried to be offered by Zoe Lofgren of California, who is she's a liberal Democrat, but she's a true civil libertarian, unlike, unfortunately, some in the Democratic caucus. And Ted Poe of Texas, who's a staunch conservative Republican, but he is also a constitutionalist, has tendencies, and he recognizes that mass surveillance is not necessary for our safety, and it is a danger to our liberty. But these were blocked in the House because the only way that the Judiciary Committee was able to get an agreement from leadership to bring up any version of the USA Freedom was to have the Intelligence Committee bless the bill before it was even considered in the committee, which I have never heard of that happening before. And the Intelligence Committee is a committee where you don't get on it unless you're interested in preserving the ability of the intelligence agency, so-called intelligence agencies, because they're really not that bright to deserve the name intelligence agencies, to snoop on us. And the chairman of the committee actually referred to Representative Justin Amash as Al-Qaeda's best friend in Congress. That gives you the idea of the type of people that John Boehner was saying that before any pro-civil liberties, so-called pro-civil liberties legislation moves out of Judiciary Committee, you have to get this guy's support, someone who thinks that Justin Amash is Al-Qaeda's best friend because Representative Amash actually cares about the Fourth Amendment.
Right. Yeah.
So hopefully, at the very least, I think that we could get out of this is some real teeth put in to this. But even that, at this point, after the second court decision, which I know you've discussed with Marcy Wheeler, said that 215 was didn't authorize the metadata programs.
Right.
That even that would be at best a good step forward, but it wouldn't be complete. I mean, we should really not be satisfied with anything but getting rid of 215 right now, and that should continue to be our long term goal.
Right.
Do
you worry that the USA Freedom Act will end up kind of, even though it's not much of a reform, it'll take the wind out of the sails of the push for, you know, a real abolition of this?
You know, this is another good thing about what's happened yesterday, is the fact that people like us are now talking about that question, and more people are listening to that question, thanks to Senator Paul's efforts yesterday, because I think he really did a wonderful job of highlighting the flaws in USA Freedom, and he put a few people on kind of the defensive who were had been pushing USA Freedom as the solution to all our problems, including the senator from your state, Senator Cruz, mm-hmm. who while you, I'm sure, have some disagreements with Senator Cruz on a few issues, he's not been horrible on NSA surveillance, but unfortunately, he is buying into the line that we don't need to get rid of 215. We need to pass the USA Freedom Act. And I think that because of Rand's filibuster or talkathon or whatever people want to call it, and because of the efforts of Campaign for Liberty, it has actually, I think he's moving more in the direction of recognizing that USA Freedom has passed in the House, needs a little work, and he may eventually even come around to saying just scrap 215 altogether. And also, I don't know if you saw it, Scott, but Senator Cruz made a point of recognizing not just Senator Paul for his efforts against the surveillance state, but of acknowledging that Senator Paul's father for years was the leading voice in Congress against the surveillance state. And I know that you, like myself, are a huge fan of Senator Paul's father, the wonderful Dr. Ron Paul. And it was nice to see that Senator Cruz took time to acknowledge all the great work that Ron Paul has done and continues to do in educating and mobilizing the American people about the dangers to our liberties.
Yeah, absolutely. He's been 100% perfect on all these issues for, you know, ever since coming back in 1997. And, of course, I know you've seen, I don't know if people have seen the clip of Ron Paul in 1984 talking about federal databases of all the American people and all the implications for our privacy back then. And his farewell speech. Man, those drums mean we got to go. Thanks, Norm. Great interview, man. I really appreciate it and very happy to talk to you again.
Thank you.
All right, everybody, that's the great Norm Singleton. He's at the Campaign for Liberty. We'll be right back.
Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop, which is, by the way, what he's doing right now, selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com.
Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for Liberty.me, the social network and community-based publishing platform for the liberty-minded. Liberty.me combines the best of social media technology all in one place and features classes, discussions, guides, events, publishing, podcasts, and so much more. And Jeffrey Tucker and I are starting a new monthly show at Liberty.me, Eye on the Empire. It's just $4 a month if you use promo code Scott when you sign up. And hey, once you do, add me as a friend on there at scotthorton.liberty.me. Be free. Liberty.me.
All right, guys, welcome back to the show. It's my show, Scott Horton's show. I got Iraq and Yemen war news, Syria, maybe Syria too, yeah. Here in just a sec, but got to go back to Iraq War 03 again. We're running a piece on antiwar.com today, which is worth clicking on just for the picture. I mean, what a great picture. George Bush Jr. This guy. Anyway, it's by James Fallows. It's called The Right and Wrong Questions About the Iraq War. And it's about this whole, you know, if we knew then what we knew now and bad intelligence and this and that. And, you know, by the way, part of it, and I guess I say this sometimes, but not too often. Part of the weird thing about being a radio guy is you never really know who you're talking to, right? So, for a lot of you guys, yeah, Scott, we knew that then. So, please, you know, now we're 12 years out. Don't tell us again what we already have known this whole damn time. But here's the thing, though. Some people really didn't know that. Some people only now are emotionally divorced enough from that time that they might even be able to entertain the possibility that they were lied to and bought it then. And so that's what James Fallows writes, is that we were presented with, Junior and the others, were presented with bad intelligence by the intelligence community, and then they made a good faith decision based on that bad intelligence, and that's just not true. And what James Fallows says is, here I am, a writer for The Atlantic, and I started working on their upcoming war with Iraq at the end of 01. Anybody who was paying close attention, either really for it or really against it, could have told you in 2001 that they're going to invade Iraq. It was that simple. You know, all you had to do was read William Safire. All you had to do was watch Fox News. I mean, it was on. And they hadn't even really decided on the mantra of weapons of mass destruction. It was basically kind of one of the talking points. But the idea basically was, we want to invade Iraq for various reasons, none of which are good enough to start a war, to invade and occupy a country. So, you know, whatever it is we have to tell you for the next year and a half to get you scared enough, the next 2 years to get you scared enough to support it. And they were using the term regime change. I mean, they already were back in the 1990s, but they were already using the term regime change for Iraq. And then, as Fallows says here, you know, it wasn't until August that Dick Cheney went and gave his gigantic lie of a speech to the veterans of foreign wars. Hey, all you old men who fought in Korea, in Vietnam, in the first Gulf War, give me your son, your grandson, your great-grandson to go fight a noble war to stop Saddam Hussein from nuking us with his reconstituted nuclear weapons, Dick Cheney claimed. That wasn't until August of 2002. And yet they've been talking about it already, on and on and on. And so anyway, I think it's important too, because it's not just that they lied us into war. It's how many Americans, count them with me now, better than 100 million, right? Better than 150 million Americans decided, yeah, okay, if this is what we're doing, we're doing it. Even though anyone who was willing to look closely at all could have seen that Saddam was not friends with Osama and had nothing to do with the 9/11 attack. And as we talked about on the show yesterday, even the National Intelligence Estimate of the CIA, even according to the New York Times and CNN, they couldn't help but admit that National Intelligence Estimate says if he has chemical weapons, which they said he did, he wouldn't use them on us unless we invade, and he might use them to keep us out of Baghdad, which he ended up not doing because he didn't have them. But anyway, you had to want to believe George Bush. You had to have a bloodlust that not enough Arabs have died as revenge for 9/11, and we want to see more people get killed. We want more war, and we're not done killing yet. To want to believe in that war. Because otherwise, you could have asked yourself the question, well, Saddam had done 9/11, then why didn't we attack him immediately? We attacked Afghanistan. Oh, okay, well, they gave Osama 6 weeks to run. But then they attacked Afghanistan. Why didn't they attack Iraq? They got base all over the place. They'd been bombing Iraq on average every other day for 8 years, for 10 years at that point. So why didn't they really bomb the crap out of Iraq? Why didn't they start the war? Right, because it had nothing to do with revenge for that. You had to want to believe that the lying, screaming jingoists on Fox were telling the truth when they were pretending that Saddam was friends with Osama. You know, there's a documentary called World War IV. It's a former Bush staffer who kind of felt betrayed about how crazy everything got and all that. And he made this thing. I interviewed him about it back when. And part of the movie is a New York cop who was there something on 9/11. And then whose son was a firefighter who died there that day. I don't know exactly where he was, but his son had died there that day. And how he was all for the war. And then years later, he finally saw a clip of Bush Jr. saying, I never said Saddam did 9/11. I never said that. No one in my government ever implied that. And he said, wait, what? But what do we bomb him for then? That was how the American people figured out. I told the anecdote a million times about the guy in my cab. Of course Saddam did it, or else why would we be attacking him? They never could give you a good reason to do it, so you had to make it up yourself. I mean, there were liars, you know, neocon liars, but Bush never said that. Condi Rice never said that. Dick Cheney did. But it was not the government's official position that the reason we're doing this is because of 9/11. Bush had a great lie. He would say, why are we attacking Iraq? Because of September 11th. Because that day we learned that from now on we have to start all the wars rather than wait around for somebody to attack us first. But in that whole giant silence, you were supposed to figure out for yourself that, well, Junior's kind of an idiot, and he doesn't speak English very well. And apparently what he was trying to say was because they did 9/11, right? Isn't that what he said? Because of September 11th. That's why we're attacking Iraq. Because of September 11th. because we learned a lesson that day. We can bomb whoever we want, start whatever war we want, pretend that we believe Lori Milroy, whatever it is, you know. So anyway, I'm glad to see that James Fallows is pointing this out, that like, hey, come on, guys, let's not lie. Let's not let these Republicans get away with pretending that the CIA convinced Bush to do this war, when in fact, Dick Cheney and Scooter Libby, his chief of staff, who despite the ridiculous childish nickname, was actually a real scary ball breaker, kind of a bureaucrat as far as bureaucrats go, and Newt Gingrich from Richard Perle's Defense Policy Board over at the Pentagon. Well, just Cheney and Libby themselves made 14 trips, and Gingrich made another dozen or so himself, over to the CIA to say, come on, where are the goods? Come up with some stuff on Saddam. Pressuring them to do it, not the other way around. And yeah, the CIA gave in to them and put out a bunch of crap. I'm not saying they didn't, but they were clearly being made to do so by their political bosses. And in fact, they weren't doing a good enough job. So as everybody knows, they set up a separate group called the Office of Special Plans at the Pentagon that was run by Douglas Feith and Abram Shulsky and Elliot Abrams and Michael Rubin and Michael Ledeen and few others. And what they did was they basically went cherry picking through the CIA's trash, coming up with whatever they could to try to make the case. So yeah, that's how we got out of the war. Did you know that? Hey, all Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at darrenscoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world. All specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. darrenscoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and you get free shipping. darrenscoffee.com. All right, guys, welcome back to the goddamn thing here. It's my show, Scott Horton Show. Ramadi fell to the Islamic State. ISIS once again secures large numbers of weapons from the Americans, writes Jason Ditz at news.antiwar.com. Tanks and artillery. Yep, so much for air war accomplishing your goals there. Hey, you know, it's funny, too, because I'm kind of about a third of a conspiracy nut on the idea that the Americans knew good and damned well that supporting the revolution in Syria would lead to something like this, and they were just happy to see it because, hey, go ahead and weaken Iran and let there be a caliphate. That's just better for our propaganda and selling more weapons. And then, you know, mostly I think, nah, they didn't think it was going to go this far. And the Iraqi government would completely lose control of all of Mosul, Fallujah, Ramadi. That they'd really have an Islamic State, not a group, but a place called the Islamic State. Oh, man, they couldn't possibly, I don't know, man. That is just so damned horrible that, nah, I don't know. But part of me thinks that, hey, I mean, and look, it's beyond dispute that the Americans have helped insist that Assad must go and that the rebels win, have worked with our allies to finance and arm them this whole time for 4 freaking years now, and still, even a year after the rise of the Islamic State. Boy, I don't know. If that ain't their goal, they sure are just going on anyway with what they're doing, even though they are the de facto air force of ISIS and al-Nusra. I don't know. In Syria, anyway. And I don't mean Air Force, literally. I guess when they bomb Syria, they're mostly bombing ISIS targets. But then again, CIA and the Rangers on the ground are training and arming up guys who then join ISIS and bring their weapons with them, or just sell all their weapons to ISIS or to al-Nusra, which is... They keep trying to spin al-Nusra like it's a nicer ISIS. Yet, those are the guys who are still sworn loyal to al-Qaeda, as opposed to ISIS, which broke off from them and are, at this point, their enemy. But anyway, here's the thing about it. Going back to the whole kind of thing about, well, I mean, what is clearly the policy in Syria, and then if you want to take it kind of to the nth degree that they are deliberately doing this to Iraq as well, they're not hurting Iran. They're just helping Iran. War is the health of the Islamic Republic. War is the health of the Islamic State and their enemies, the Iranians, too. If Iran had influence over the Dawa Party and the Badr Brigade and Asaib al-Haq and the Mahdi Army and whatever other Shiite militias before, well, how much do they have now? That the Shiite government in Baghdad needs them badly as boots on their ground. When the Americans are gone, the Americans have nothing to offer but planes. And, you know, a few thousand guys, but mostly the few thousand guys there are trainers or their special forces pointing lasers, you know, spies and mercs, but not a field army. And, you know, apparently not enough special forces to lead the Iraqi divisions. They're leaving that up to the Iranians. And, of course, the Sadrists have said, if the Americans come into battle here, we'll attack them. You are kicked out and you're going to stay kicked out. That's the solderist position. I'm pretty sure the Badr Brigade, you know, I don't know, they'd probably be happy to go back to the previous relationship with the U.S. Army. Works for them. It worked real well for them for quite a few years there. But, anyway, if the whole policy is the redirection to weaken Iran, all they're doing is giving Iran an excuse to double, triple, quadruple, or more their influence in Iraq. To divert more resources to the Iraqis to keep the Islamic State at bay. And so, the Iraqis, meaning the sectarian Shiite government, Dawa Party, Supreme Islamic Council government in Baghdad, that George Bush put there. So, yeah, I don't know, man. You know, I'm always saying there's no one in the neighborhood who can take them except the Turks, who won't because they like them. But maybe it will come to the Iranians doing a real invasion of Iraq on the side of America's side, the Shiite side in Iraq, against the Islamic State. I think that's pretty much what it would take. But then think about the reaction in the region to that. What would the Turks do? Would the Turks fight the Iranians at that point? To keep the jihadists in charge of Mosul, for example? But I think at this point, you can just call Iraq off. I mean, Kurdistan is de facto independent for what that's worth. I guess, you know, American foreign policy promoter types are going to insist on calling southern Shiistan, Iraq, and pretend that the Islamic State is just some rogue province. Right, like when they pretended that Chiang Kai-shek on Taiwan was the only legitimate government of China when Mao ruled all of the rest of it. Hundreds of millions of people for 25 years or something before they actually, recognized him as the government of China. It was not till Nixon, right? Anyway. Iraq's over. The Islamic State is a real place. That's what Coburn's been trying to emphasize. Oh, yeah, no, they done did it, man. I'm paraphrasing roughly. And so I think, you know, they ought to have a contest of what to call the land between, including and between Baghdad and Kuwait, down to Kuwait there. Shiistan. That one's kind of boring. You could call it George W. Bushistan. Or how about Ayatollah Bushistan? And then that way you're covering all your bases. You're building a lot of description into your title there. Ayatollah Bushistan. Forever at war with the Islamic State. And now, by the way, Mitchell Prothero says, nah, the ISIS fighters are converging on the airbase in the Anbar province, the last holdout of the Americans in Anbar. And they're preparing for an assault to retake Ramadi. Jeez, they had half the city a week and a half ago and didn't reinforce it. Now they got to retake the whole thing, huh? I guess we'll see what happens. And, you know, the Americans were saying, literally, they're saying, ah, don't worry about it. Ramadi, we can retake it whenever we want. It's not a big deal. I guess. Let's see.
Hey, I'll Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. If this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Robertson Roberts Brokerage, Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Robertson Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co.
All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. I sure like this headline anyway. John Kerry admits defeat. And it's not about the Iran nuclear thing. I'd be bothered if it was about that. But about anything else, I'm happy with it. He's already defeated on the Palestinian state thing, so. Everything else that he's up to is horrible. So I'm glad that he's been defeated. Welcome back to the show. It's Patrick L. Smith from Salon.com. How are you doing?
I'm well, Scott. Good to be back with you.
Very good to talk to you again. So it says here, the U.S. seems to admit it overplayed its hand in Ukraine. And you're talking here about John Kerry's trip to Russia. He went over there, met with Lavrov and Putin all day long. Is that it?
3 hours with Lavrov, who is a very competent foreign minister. Kerry has a somewhat personal friendship with him, developed over a lot of months, and then four with Beelzebub, Putin. I don't know what that makes Kerry. Does that make him the Neville Chamberlain of our time, or what? I don't. I say no.
He's tied
I
to
say
the
no,
Russians
it does
now.
Not, right? I want to take you back to a little ways, Scott.
Okay.
Yes, I have been cheering on an American defeat in Ukraine since the coup of February 2014. I want to tell your listeners, if I may, this is a very honorable position, okay? In the late 60s, we had quite eminent historians. I'll name one, Henry Steele Commager, one of the great American historians of the 20th century, saying we need to be defeated in Vietnam. It's the same sentiment. We're wrong. And we will not take no for an answer, so we're going to have a bloody nose. Kerry going to Sochi precluded a bloody nose for now. We don't know what's next from the State Department. And I think it's altogether a good thing that we appear to be capitulating in the Ukraine matter.
So you're saying that, to sum it up then, when Kerry goes to Russia and meets with Lavrov and Putin like this, that's sort of de facto signing on to Minsk, too, and saying, okay, we'll stop screwing around for our side.
That's right. I mean, the infamous Victoria Nuland was so, if I may use the word, really very slimy on this matter. Nuland, indeed Kerry, when Minsk II was signed, they did everything within their power to sink it. They did not want a negotiated settlement. That involves compromise. American leaders don't like compromise. But they were beaten. The Europeans trumped us. Again, I couldn't be more pleased. And so now they're kind of playing catch-up, and they've finally come to their senses and said, the Minsk II framework, very imperfect, kind of Swiss cheesy for all its empty spaces, but it is the framework of a negotiated settlement. It's the best we've got, and that is the avenue the Europeans and Moscow are going to travel. It depends on two things now. Well, until this moment, it depended on two things. It depended on how the Americans behaved, whether they would succeed in sabotaging, the agreement, and how the Ukrainians behaved, how the Kiev government behaved. The Americans appear to have settled now and said, okay, we'll do it your way. The people in Kiev, you know, the Europeans have been complaining. I hear from sources what you get from the German foreign ministry is these people in Kiev are impossible. They never tell you what they're going to do next. And when they do tell you what they're going to do next, they do something else. They're wild cards. They're loose cannons.
All right. So now, but this doesn't really mean, or does it mean, that they're canceling the training exercises, or they're just
no? The troop trainers were kind of a secondary. The primary preference the Americans had until quite recently, until Minsk too, was arms. Okay. We proposed, by way of the New York Times, sending arms to Ukraine on February 1st. Chancellor Merkel and her colleague, François Hollande, went into apoplectic over that, so far as I can make out, and got straight into gear and said, okay, this is it with the Americans. We're going to go our own way. Do the math. Minsk II was signed 10 days after that New York Times story. Mm-hmm. This was a race to the finish line, and the Europeans beat us. The troops followed that. They arrived April 16. Okay, they're there. They're kind of a placeholder. I am very disturbed by their presence, of course. I'm old enough to remember the Vietnam War. Maybe a number of your listeners are not. They should read up. This is how it always starts. But that's kind of a placeholding thing. I think your listeners, certainly I, take it as, at this point, a dangerous reminder, but a reminder only, that we don't know what's next from the Americans. For now, they are acquiescing in the pursuit of a negotiated settlement. For now, in italics. Who knows?
Right.
You know.
All right. Now, so as far as the wild card coup d'etat junta there in Kiev, who's
yes.
behind all these assassinations? Does anybody know there's been more than a dozen assassinations of, I think they're virtually to a man, all of them associated with the last president's government. Isn't that right?
Yes. A few things mark them out. First of all, Scott, you and I are having this conversation we're talking into a very extensive news blackout, okay? I don't expect many of your readers to be aware of this wave of assassinations. As I wrote in a column, it sort of reminds me of Argentina in the late 70s. And the corruptions that are now emerging involving the new government, perhaps we'll get to those. The assassination started coincidentally with the arrival of the American troops. No causality suggested. But between April 15th or 16th, the first of them, and the very first few days of May, there were a dozen. I got my count from sources I find quite reliable, 12 to 13. Do the math, Scott. That's not quite one a day, but it's pretty close. Bad stuff. One, they were political allies of the Yanukovych government, the government that was toppled. Two, they were critics of the current government's corruptions. Three, they advocated a less than drastic breach with Russia as it moves westward, perfectly sensible position. Four, this is the one that really gets my goat, 27 million Russians died to defeat Nazism. They advocated honoring them on the 70th anniversary of the Soviet victory. Death.
Yeah.
Those are the characteristics that unite these victims of assassination.
Yeah. It's crazy living in the bloodlands. You know, of course, the Soviets had killed millions of Ukrainians before the Nazis ever showed up. So,
right.
It's not like, oh, good, the, you know, our saviors are here to save us from, to, you know, protect us from the other side. And, you know,
Ukrainian
in America, we're liberals
is,
and conservatives at least pretend to hate each other so much and call each other commie and fascist all the time. Over there, they really are commies and fascists. And so you imagine how
say,
much
Ukrainian
bad blood they have there.
Very
you know?
Complicated. Yeah. The Ukrainian
hold it, Patrick. We've
got to
take this break. We'll be right back, everybody. Patrick L. Smith from Salon.com. John Kerry admits defeat. Thank goodness. More in a minute. Hey, y'all. Scott Horton here. Are you a libertarian and or peacenik? Live in North America? If you want, you can hire me to come and give a speech to your group. I'm good on the terror, war, and intervention, civil liberty stuff, blaming Woodrow Wilson for everything bad in the world, Iran, central banking, political realignment, and, well, you know, everything. I can teach markets to liberals and peace to the right. Just watch me. Check out scotthorton.org/speeches for some examples, and email me, scott@scotthorton.org, for more information. See you there. All right, guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. I'm talking with Patrick L. Smith. He writes for Salon.com. And, oh, let me page down so I can tell you he's the author of the book Time No Longer, Americans After the American Century. We're talking about the fight that the U.S. picked in Ukraine and how we're now backing off. And at the break there, right before it, we were talking about the assassinations of people in the Kiev government or close to the Kiev government who were close to the last regime that was overthrown in the American-backed coup of February 2014 and just how dicey things are getting for people who are trying to participate in power there who fall out of line. And that kind of led me to the question I was going to ask you, Patrick, was
please.
I had read from, I forget the source now, but it was, I think, Andriy Poruby, the leader of, it was either the leader of Right Sector or this Svoboda or something, and they were saying,
mm-hmm.
forget Minsk II, we don't respect Minsk II, and if we can overthrow Yanukovych, we can sure as hell overthrow Poroshenko, and he has no right to negotiate a ceasefire on our behalf, and we're a bunch of Hitler-loving Nazis, and we want to keep fighting anyway, he said. And so I wonder if you think that there's a real danger of that the Nazis that America and their sock puppets have used as their sock puppets could come back to bite them in the ass here and end up taking power in Kiev.
Yes, let there be no question. The main impediment, as I said earlier, there were two threatening impediments to Minsk II. One was the next move by the Americans. We were turned back, as noted. The second was the behavior of the government in Kiev. These people, it is quite known outside of the United States, if I have to keep saying that, but it is the way it is, that these people are the tail wagging the dog in Kiev. The government is disturbingly beholden to these paramils and crypto Nazis. In some cases, you can drop crypto. They're right out there. They occupy very prominent places in the government. They had to be given those places. They have already said, post-Minsk II, there is no way we're going to let you negotiate a settlement in the framework of that agreement. They have begun to pass legislation counter to the provisions of Minsk II. They are a serious danger to the European effort to negotiate this settlement in concert with Moscow. And I have it from quite reliable sources that Poroshenko, the president, and his prime minister, Arseniy Yatsenyuk, are not all that far from the threat of a coup. These are dangerous guys.
What's the relative strength of their armed men versus the Nazis?
You mean the Ukrainian army?
Yeah, or whatever security forces they have that are loyal to them rather than to the legacy of Adolf Hitler.
Right. The Ukrainian army was not capable of waging the civil war in the East on its own. It could not do it. It started that way. The first week or 10 days of the offensive eastward, we had Ukrainian uniformed troops coming into villages and throwing up their hands and saying, we can't do this. Here, take the tank. There was no commitment. There was no training. The Army is well known for the depths of its corruptions at senior levels. NATO would like to, just for example, NATO would like to provide the Ukrainian Army with some funding. It will not do it because it cannot tell where the money's going. So the militias organized privately in these gangs of 100, there's an expression for them, formed, and they were the advanced guard of the war in the East. They were absolutely essential, and they are apparently quite savage, bloodletting fighters. A lot of stories of pretty awful kind of war criminal behavior going on when they took a town or a village.
Mm-hmm. Well, and, you know, The Intercept even had a thing where Chechen jihadists were fighting on the side of the Nazis against the Russian-backed so-called separatists there.
That's right. Yeah, it's a real salad over there, I have to say. But these paramils, heavily salted with neo-fascists and Nazis of various sorts, are now gathered together in what is called the National Guard. And the salient fact for your listeners is the American trainers over there are not training the regular Ukrainian army. They are training the National Guard.
Right.
So guess who they're training?
Yeah, and starting
on... It makes the stomach turn.
Yeah, and starting on April the 20th. And I'm sorry, I wish I had remembered that this is where we left off 2 weeks ago, the point that we didn't have time to get back to.
Yeah.
That I wanted to ask you to clarify was exactly this point, that the regular Ukrainian army, as far as we know, doesn't necessarily have a bunch of Nazis in it. But the Ukrainian National Guard is basically just the fancy pretend legitimate name for these Nazi militias.
Yes, Poroshenko... probably, I don't think Poroshenko comes to a single solitary conclusion on his own, but he concluded at the behest of probably the Americans, look, you're overly dependent on these people, sweep them up, we got to start organizing them, and we'll send some trainers over. That's my notion of the
yeah, and then once the U.S. makes better armed fighter and better trained fighters out of them, then they'll quit being Nazis because of their fancy new uniforms. They won't have, at least they won't have the SS lightning bolts on their shoulder anymore. You know?
Well, we got now, Scott, we got to wait and see what they do have on their epaulettes.
Man, oh man.
It makes the head turn and the stomach, it makes the head spin and the stomach turn. That's a lot for one day, I would say.
Yeah, it's amazing. And you know what? I still can't get over, and you know what? Maybe it's your base level kind of irony to plagiarize Bill Hicks there, but the fact that it's the first black president who is the first time, the first leader really to field Nazis in battle since Hitler did in World War II in Europe is just amazing. It's just as amazing how, you know, the way he backed the Ku Klux Klan basically in Libya, who, you know, rage their anti-black pogroms against.
I just told you, Scott, what happens when I contemplate these things, what happens to my stomach and my head, and it happens all over again when I contemplate our president. How treacherous has he proven, really? Who would have guessed, you know?
Yeah.
I think he's...
Ha, just wait till Jeb comes. It's
going
to be so much worse.
Please, better let us end on a more pleasant note.
Well, okay. When Jeb comes, liberals will pretend to care about war again, and then so we'll have a little bit louder voice for a little while.
I love your skepticism. I loved your permanently arched eyebrow, Scott.
Yeah, that's the fun part of being a libertarian is I don't get to be pleased for 4 or 8 years and then trade off like the rest of y'all, you know? I'm always angry.
Anyway, you seem to have a pretty good grip on what's going on over there. That's good. Not many Americans do. It's part of our problem. We're flying blind.
Hey,
right?
Here's something that we can talk about to wrap up then. So who should my audience be reading if they want to know about this stuff?
other than you?
Interesting. Non-American media, all right? You get accounts of the composition of the Ukrainian forces in, you know, Tory newspapers like the Daily Telegraph, right? Non-American media, choose your stripe, I don't care. Conservative, liberal, lefty, there's way more, all right? American authors, there's a scholar at the University of Chicago, a very honorable man named John Mearsheimer. Read him. Stephen Cohen, much under siege these days. I interviewed him for the column a few weeks ago. Those columns traveled a mile. They're still out there around, translated into French and Russian. Stephen is on the nose. He brings 40 years of scholarship to it. He's a serious man. He is not ideologically motivated, as he said in one interview. My problem is I don't have an ism, and I'm not an ist. I'm not a socialist. I'm not a communist. I'm not any of that. He's just a clean scholar. That's his problem. You bring a non-ideological take to these conversations. That's bad in our American context. Steve Cohen, Mearsheimer, Robert Parry, P-A-R-R-Y, consortiumnews.com, doing a really good job. I commentate. Robert reports it. He gets good facts. I found, finally, Stephen Wiseman, W-E-I-S, maybe two S's, maybe one, reader-supported news. Wiseman, he seems to have dropped out of sight lately. He had some superb stuff about what went on under the surface in Ukraine by way of American subterfuge.
Yeah. I'd add James Carden at the National Interest. He has some good stuff, too.
Does he?
Yeah, and of course, Dan McAdams at the Ron Paul Institute for Peace and Prosperity.
Right. Yeah.
He's got great stuff all the time.
Yeah. Anyway, there are things to read, but regrettably, one must make here in our great country more effort than most of us assume necessary to find out what's going on, right? We have the sort of cotton wool of mainstream media, and you won't know what in the world is happening over there. Not much will make sense if you just rely on them, you know? Good for you to put people on who can speak truth to power, as they say.
Yeah, I'm trying. I sure appreciate the job you're doing. So,
thank you, Scott.
And I appreciate your time for coming back on the show, too, Patrick.
You're very welcome. We'll do it again.
Okay, take care.
Cheers.
All right, y'all, that's Patrick L. Smith. He writes at Salon.com, and his book is called, again, Time No Longer, Americans After the American Century. And his latest article is John Kerry Admits Defeat, the Ukraine Story the Media Won't Tell. And it's running on antiwar.com today as well. See ya.